The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I would like to explore the topic of equanimity with you. Equanimity is a word that was probably not in my working vocabulary before I started doing Buddhist practice. And maybe for some of you, you know what it is, kind of, but it's not something you use regularly. It's a very important mental quality, mental state in Buddhist practice. It's considered to be one of the more pristine or satisfying or meaningful states or qualities to have, even though some people, when they first hear about it, confuse it with indifference or aloofness and feel like it just confirms that these Buddhists are cold. And, you know, equanimous. But it's actually quite a beautiful state and experience. And it's very important for Buddhist practice as a whole because equanimity itself is a kind of a freedom from reactivity and being caught and preoccupied and pushed around by experiences in life. It's kind of a freedom there. But also it's considered to be the stepping stone, a very good kind of a platform or diving board or, something for liberation, for the kind of freedom, the ultimate freedom which Buddhism points to. So it's a good thing to consider. And what I'd like to do today is to introduce to you the idea of three different kinds of equanimity. Because it's such an important quality in Buddhism, it's maybe a little bit like they say, the Eskimos have so many words for snow. Buddhists have a lot of things they associate with equanimity. They parse it out, they understand different kinds. And so there's one list of three kinds of equanimity, and that's the equanimity of balance, the equanimity of love, and the equanimity of wisdom. So those are the three to cover. So to begin, I'd like to tell one of the great myths of Buddhism. Kind of myths contain kind of the archetypical stories or images for a tradition, and so they're certainly for Buddhism as well. And so it, as a myth, it's kind of evocative, and it also kind of points to symbolically to other things besides itself. And one of the great myths is the story of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree on a full moon night in May in northern India. And he was sat, rooted in his place, committed to the practice, and going to be unwavering in his pursuit, commitment for liberation, for freedom. And as he sat there, Mara came to visit him. And some people kind of associate Mara kind of like this Buddhist devil. But Mara is, in the ancient Indian pantheon of gods, was a particular god who didn't like it when people became liberated. Because when they became liberated, they kind of left his realm that he rules, kind of in charge of. And he wants to be in charge, like he's kind of a little bit control freak. And so he can't control people if they get free. And so Mara came to the site of the Buddha's awakening and did whatever he could to prevent the Buddha's awakening, his freedom. And so he came forth with all his armies and all this amazing array of different ancient Indian weapons, arrows and spears and discs and, scythes, I don't know, whatever they could. And he came with huge, the myths go on, describe this huge, huge field of battalions of soldiers and armies. And they've come from all directions. And they're gods, right? So they're up in the sky, too. It's not like, all directions means a lot. And thunderous and loud and lightning and thunder and gore and faces of, you can imagine fierce, violent faces with teeth and fangs and, you can imagine these, the picture, maybe. The Buddha sat there equanimous and unmoved, was unfazed by this. And in fact, all the arrows and weapons and spears that were thrown at the Buddha turned into flowers and fell peacefully to the ground. So Mara didn't like this, of course, so then Mara tried something else, since the armies didn't seem to work to scare the Buddha. So Mara had quite attractive daughters. And the daughters had names like lust and passion, and I don't know what the names were, but they were names like that. So three of them. And so he came with his daughters and presented his daughter, said, "You go there and do what you can to seduce this man, this monk." And so I'll leave that to your imagination. how these myths work, you know, what they try to do in order to get his attention, first of all, and try to kind of get him to come out of his meditation. And again, he was unfazed, unmoved. He stayed equanimous and balanced through it. And then Mara came with his ultimate weapon, and that was doubt. Because that can get people, you know, nothing else does. And he said to the Buddha, he basically compared himself to the Buddha, said, "I'm a god. I've done so much good merit in the past, and lifetimes after lifetimes, that I deserve to be the kind of certain king of the gods, the control of this domain in some place. And, you know, what right do you have to sit here in this spot? What right do you have to get awakened? Who are you? Who do you think you are?" But the Buddha responded this time. He didn't lose his equanimity or his balance, but he did offer a kind of response. And what he did is that he put his hand to the ground, and one hand, his right hand, you see the statue sometimes, many statues like this, he's earth-touching gesture, he's touching the earth. And he calls upon the Mother Earth, the Goddess Earth, to be the witness to his right to be awakened. Because the Earth Goddess, see what happened in the story, in the myth, is that, remember, Mara has all these armies and minions who are with him. So he turns to them and says, you know, "Are you my witness for all the merit and great deeds that I've done so that I could become a great god?" And they say, "Yes, you've done a lot, because you have to do a lot of good merit, even to become a bad god." So he had all these witnesses. But the Buddha was just this monk sitting under a tree with nobody around, right? So who was going to be his witness? So he calls upon the Earth Goddess, who's been around for millennia. And the Earth Goddess is the witness to Buddha's, all his good past deeds and his right and all that. And so then the Earth Goddess responded by having an earthquake. And that got Mara's attention. And then Mara ran away. And the Buddha then stayed equanimous through the earthquake. And then the story is a happily ever after story, right? He became awakened. So that's kind of the kind of this archetypical picture, story of a person who stayed equanimous. And if we take it symbolically a little bit, one of the understandings of the tradition is that Mara is a personification of a lot of the ordinary things that happen to people, that cause people to lose their equanimity, to cause agitation in the mind, preoccupation, get us wrapped up, caught up in the world. And some of these things that Mara is famous for, the armies of Mara, are ordinary things like tiredness and hunger and thirst. They're not evil, they're not bad. That's why Mara's not seen as a devil. But, you know, if, they say that, you know, that you probably have the experience that if you're tired and hungry, you're maybe not fit for civil company. You know, sometimes when people are angry, they ask, "Are you tired? Are you hungry?" And perhaps if you are, you need to take care of those, because it can put us on the edge quite easily, quite quickly. Health problems. There's all kinds of things that happen in the world, difficulties in the world that can be challenging and difficult to be with. And then there are things like jealousy and lust and anger and fear, that can come along. All these things are considered armies of Mara, if you kind of play out this myth, because they're all the things in the world, and you can go make up your own list of your army of Mara, all the things that get your mind agitated, get your mind worked up, get your mind cut up and concerned, and you sit down to meditate, and you're still going, 100 miles an hour, because how could she, how could he, or maybe it's like a beautiful, you're calm, things are good, you're happy and contented, as you create this fantastic fantasy of sexual pleasure. And boy, this is like so nice and it's wonderful, and your mind drifts off, and the bell rings at the end of the meditation. Boy, that was a quick meditation. That was no problem. I'll come back again. But, that's Mara too, right? Mara has all kinds of ways of getting the mind caught. And so it's an ordinary thing for the mind to get caught up and to get preoccupied and to lose its balance, to lose its equanimity, to lose its poise. And it goes chasing after things, runs away, runs around in circles, gets reactive, gets caught up in reactive loops of mental behavior and activity. And there's no freedom in the mind and the heart when that goes on. And so in contrast to that is the Buddha in this story. He's sitting on the ground, solid earth that supports him. It's beautiful, this cross-legged yogic position, sitting in lotus posture. Is not only a nice, stable posture, but it also represents tremendous stability. It's tripod. People sometimes liken it to a mountain, the stability of a mountain. And so here he is on the ground, stable, rooted, and with the back spine that's straight and upright, with eyes. The eyes usually are considered to be half open, so he sees what goes on around him. And breathing, it's often like you in our statue here, you see the chest is a little bit extended, and it's usually considered to be an example of someone who's breathing harmoniously, breathing easefully. And so that's the way the artists do it sometimes, is have the... He's not puffed up and conceited. He's just breathing nicely and freely. And so he represents the capacity of human beings to be balanced, to be centered, to not be caught by our experience, to be free, and to be at ease, to have a certain kind of peacefulness, not to have the mind caught in its loops, caught in its concerns over and over again. And so... this is the image, this dramatic image. Mara on one side, the equanimous Buddha on the other. So how does this work for us? And the task of any kind of story like this and the myth is not to react to the story. That's a silly story. And, these Buddhists tell fairy tales. And, you could do that if you want. But if you're interested in the practice, you're not that interested in judging a story. But rather, what's helpful to do is to interpret the story for yourself, apply it to yourself, find how is this true for me. So, is there something like what the symbolism this myth points to? Is this true for me? Am I somehow? Are the things that I get caught up in? Do I get caught by fear? Am I anxious a lot and running around being anxious? My mind. Is there lust? Do I get reactive to the situations of my life, the ordinary biological situations? I get hungry, I get tired, I have health problems. And tomorrow you have to go to the doctor to get some news. And the mind is kind of spinning. So without judgment that that's wrong, the myth would say this is Mara, because you've been caught, you've been pulled into it. Now, with the example of a health issue, I think is very illustrative, I think important to consider, because it's very easy with a health condition to, a serious one, something that's important for your life maybe, to then justify being caught by it, being caught up and spinning around and being agitated. Like, of course you should be. It's a serious condition. And so then Mara has you. Doesn't mean that you're supposed to just kind of be indifferent and not go to the doctor. but to have the mind to be spinning and churning and you can't go to sleep to use the story, the myth, Mara has you. You're under Mara's control. You're spinning out in Kat. So a Buddhist practice, and it's a good to think of it as a process, not as a black and white thing, is to start developing and training the mind, helping the mind, nurturing the mind, so the mind can stay balanced, stay at peace, stay equanimous, no matter what the challenges you find yourself in. That you can stay the equivalent of grounded, rooted, present, eyes open, responsible and involved and connected to what's happening, but your inner life doesn't get churned by it, doesn't get caught by it, doesn't get swept away by it. And one of the advantages of that is then you can stand with a balanced stance, with the eyes open. You can you have a chance to be wise in order to see what clearly what has to happen, what needs to do, that you can't do if you're spinning around and caught up in your reactivity. It occurs to me to say that in some religious traditions they say that if someone hits you, turn the other cheek so they can hit you the other side. The Buddhist response, what do you do if someone hits you? You don't give them the other cheek. You stand there and look them in the eye. So you don't hit them back. And, you know, maybe you run away, sometimes it's good. depending what it is. But at least, you know, the more, you know, in the ideal situation, the Buddhist response is not to offer the other cheek, but rather just look them in the eye. Make a human contact and have the equanimity and the peace just to, what's going on here? Let's look at this. I'm going to look at you. And they might hit you again, of course, but I've told this many times before. So I apologize those of you who heard it, but it's a good story. I hear great things at teaching retreats. People come and tell me the stories. It's amazing what I hear. You know, it's just like sometimes I feel like I should, whatever I read in the newspapers end up comings on retreat. And I should pay attention to the newspaper because sooner or later someone will come and retreat and have been through that. And so there was someone who came to me and said that she went down to the South during the civil rights time in the 60s to protest against segregation. And she protested with some group of people on a corner of a city street and sidewalk. And these white racists came along with a pickup truck. A few of them came along and jumped out of the truck and started to beat up her and her friends, you know, punching them out. And back then there was a very strong dedication to nonviolent civil disobedience. So they didn't defend themselves. Well, it wasn't so bad because they were able to go back to the same corner the next day to do the same, stand there and protest the next day. But the same guys came and beat them up some. But apparently it wasn't that bad because they came back the next day and probably bruised. I don't know how it was. And what she told me was that on the third day, the same guy who beat her up the first 2 days stood above her with his fist ready to hit her. And she looked him in the eyes. They looked each other in the eyes. And he paused and he said, "What in the world are you doing?" He couldn't believe it. "You again, what are you doing here?" And he lowered his arm and they had a conversation. And they diffused the tension. And I don't know the result of that conversation, but there was no fight. There was just two people talking about what was going on. There was a chance for maybe some kind of dialogue. That's the story she told me, that woman on the retreat. So don't offer the other cheek, but look the person in the eye. You know, face the person, be present, be equanimous, be strong, unless the situation calls for running. So equanimity is a tremendous asset. It's one of the part of the richness of the inner life to be able to have this ability, because the opposite of it is to be poor, to be psychically, heartfully poor, because we're kind of lost ourselves. We're not really in touch with ourselves as the mind churns and it's lost and spinning. So there are three kinds of equanimity. The first is the equanimity of balance. And that is just as if you develop physical strength, have a really strong, you can maybe hold your stance and ground, and even maybe there's a strong wind, or someone comes and bumps you, and because you're strong and stable, you're balanced, then you're not going to be pushed over. But if you're weak and you've been sick for a long time and you're kind of unsteady in your feet, and someone comes along and bumps you, you'll probably fall over. So there's a kind of physical strength, you know, that can provide a certain balance. So in the same way, there can be psychological strength that we have, inner strengths that get developed, and when those are strong, they provide balance and we're not pushed around so much. And there's a variety of things that provide that inner balance. One is confidence. To have confidence in yourself, to have confidence in your capacity to respond wisely, to have confidence that there's no need to get caught up in those particular concerns that the world wants to get you caught up in. So it's a great place to cultivate this kind of balance of not being caught is to read shopping catalogs and see if you can read a catalog without having a desire. So today, someone was talking about teaching about how when people, many people, when they look at catalogs, buying catalogs, they're wanting to have a desire. They don't know what they want yet, but they want something to desire, and they're looking for that thing they can want. So can you, you know, there's all these messages in our society that want to catch us and get us, I need to get that, the latest this and that. So can you not get caught? Can you, what does it take to have, what kind of inner strength helps you not get caught? One of the forms of inner strength that Buddhism emphasizes a lot is to be happy, to have an inner sense of satisfaction and well-being. And the part of the function of a lot of Buddhist practices is to create the conditions that you feel good about yourself. You have an inner sense of satisfaction and contentment. So being ethical. Ethics is very important in Buddhism. In and of itself it's important, but it's very important to cultivate an inner sense of confidence and well-being. So you're contented in there, as opposed to being, you know, worried about getting caught. And then there's meditation practice. One of the functions of meditation practice is, in fact, to create a contented, happy state, a sense of feeling whole or complete. Be calm. So there's things we can do. We can cultivate calm, we can cultivate concentration, we can cultivate well-being to some degree, cultivate confidence. All these things support us being equanimous. And I think a lot of people will find that if they meditate, they probably are more equanimous at the end of the meditation than they were before. You can walk down the street and before meditation, someone might back into your car in the parking lot and it produces one reaction. After meditation, someone bumps into your car in the parking lot and you have much more space and equanimity and your first reaction isn't to, you know, go punch the guy out. Your first reaction is like, well, this is interesting. You know, what's this about? And then, so then you get out and you're calm and you say, you realize you don't have to react, there's no need to kind of get angry right away. Maybe later you can do it, but no need to. So you could turn around and you look and you see. And you see what goes on. And you see that, in fact, that the person who backed into you maybe is violently sick and throwing up in their front seat, and you realize, oh, something else is going on here now. And so then you have a whole different relationship to it. Then you jump out with your fists clenched and ready to, like, you know, explain why you're not at fault. You know, so after meditation, it's very common for people to have more equanimity, to have more space in the mind, so they don't react as quickly. So this basic balance, psychological change, psychological strength, psychological place that we can come to where we have equanimity of balance. We're not thrown off center so easily. Or if we're thrown off center, we easily come back right ourselves. And they say that some of the things that can throw us off balance are called in Buddhism the eight worldly winds. So the winds that push us around. Fame and ill repute, success and failure, pain and pleasure, and then there's one more, it's called gain and loss. I'm a little confused. I would have said that too, but I think there's another pair. Anyway, there's probably more pairs. And what?
Praise and blame.
And remembering during a talk and not remembering. So, you know, we get caught by these things, very common. So the balance. The second form of equanimity is the equanimity of love. And it's a little bit surprising to some people to connect equanimity with love, love with equanimity. Again, because some people feel that equanimity is, you know, kind of aloof or cold or indifferent, which it's not at all. And so the way we usually talk about this kind of the equanimity of love is to call it, usually it's called grandmotherly love, but maybe we should say nowadays grandparently love. And so the love of a grandparent loves a grandchild, but the thing about a grandparent is that usually they've raised a child. So they've gone through all the drama, at least once before. Whereas first-time parents are going through it the first time. And I can tell from experience that it's first-hand experience, the lack of equanimity of first-time parents. You know, oh my God, this is a crisis. You know, big deal. And grandparents have gone through these things before, and so they love the grandchild, but they're equanimous. They love it, but they're not caught by the drama. I mean, I don't know if it happens to some of you have parents, or some of you are parents, but, you know, when the kids are really small, they can go from literally saying, I love you, will you marry me? To, I hate you, in a matter of seconds or minutes, you know. your kid says, I hate you. Gee. My son said at one point, I think I was born in the wrong family. But you know, so I reacted internally, like, oh my God, you know, that's. I think within a day, I don't think he remembered saying it for him, you know. But I did, I can tell you, right? The first time the child falls and scrapes its knee, oh my God. But, you know, the grandparent knows a lot of these things, knows some of the cycles and developments that go on, knows some of the common experiences of a grandchild. And so some grandparents then can express their love, can invite, fix the wound, clean it up, be responsive. There's love, but they're not caught in the drama. So the equanimity of love is like that. There can be love, but we don't get hooked in. We don't get hooked into the drama, the story. And some people feel when we love someone, when we feel close to someone, that unless we get hooked in, unless we worry, that we don't show the love. That worrying and being kind of cooked in and preoccupied and spinning out with people is how we show we love someone. But that's not what the grandmother does, or the ideal one, the mythic one. And so it is possible to develop a certain kind of love where we have a lot of compassion, a lot of care, a lot of kindness, a lot of friendship for someone, and we realize that maybe one of the most profound ways that we share our love with someone is to stay balanced, to stay equanimous, to stay not caught, to stay not spinning out with them, stay present, but offer them a calm presence, accepting presence, offer them space, allow them to be who they are and what's going on, care for them, be caring, but not agitated by what goes on. The third kind of equanimity is the equanimity of wisdom. And this is the equanimity of understanding a situation well, what's going on. The ancient Buddhist word for equanimity is upekkha. And the word literally, if you take the roots of the word in mind, literally means having an overview. So having the bigger picture of what's going on. And so if you know at work that someone, you know, has family situation is very, very, very difficult, maybe someone's very sick or maybe someone's died in the family or something, and you understand that, then if they come and they snap at you at work, you understand, oh, this is, you know, this person's challenged, this person's stressed, and so this, I don't have to take this personally. So there's a wisdom and understanding that we have that allows us to not get caught or wrapped up in what just happened and take it personally. So important part of Buddhist practice is the wisdom of not taking things personally. And this is one of the major sources of having wisdom, and to understand how it's wise, how it's not necessary to take a lot of things personally. And the good news is that you don't even have to take yourself personally. Because then you can have a lot of equanimity. So all these things happen, right? You react, you get angry, you get jealous, you get afraid. And it's very easy to get caught in a loop where I'm angry and this is bad. I'm angry and I'm going to explain all the reasons why I should be and why this person is a jerk. And so we tell ourselves stories that get the anger, you know, just puts fuel on the anger. And there's all kinds of ways in which we are not equanimous by how we are. We react to it. We get involved in it. We get spin out by it. And it's something really wonderful and I think very deeply meaningful to allow yourself to be as you are, give a kind of very generosity to yourself as you are, not to feel bad about how you are at all, but don't take it personally. Don't get personally involved. Just let it be. And have this equanimity, this balance, a certain kind of love towards yourself, love of equanimity. You love yourself. It's good to love yourself, but you don't have to take yourself so personally. Don't take yourself, you're not that important after all. You know, you're the most important person in the world, but that doesn't mean you're that important. You know, it's, you know, both are true. You're the most important person in the world, but you're not that important. You're not important enough, you know. So it's okay to be who you are, but don't get so involved. Don't take everything as being so important, every thought, every feeling, every reaction. It's possible to be equanimous, where the equanimity has lots of space, so you can have a desire. You want something, you want to do something, you have an impulse, and that impulse arises in the space of the mind, space of the heart, and you see it, you know it's there, but there's no need to do anything. It's held in equanimity and peace. And if it's wise to act, you can act on it, but there's no need to. You can have fear, and the fear arises, and there's lots of space and equanimity to allow the fear to be there. It's a beautiful thing to cultivate and develop a space in the mind, equanimity in the mind, stability in the mind, peace in the mind, wisdom in the mind, so that we don't have to get hooked by what happens in the world around us. We don't get hooked into what happens within us. And part of the function of meditation, part of the function of mindfulness practice, is to cultivate the ability to see deeply what goes on in our inner life so that the inner life can move towards greater equanimity and freedom in this world that we're in. And if you do that, then you'll have access to much more wisdom. But if you don't have equanimity, if you don't have peace, chances are there's not going to be that abundance of wisdom available. So equanimity, three kinds of equanimity. Which one is strongest for you? Which one is weakest for you? The equanimity of balance, the equanimity of love, or the equanimity of wisdom and understanding? So that's what I wanted to say today. And then I know maybe it's not really the right thing to do, but hopefully you're all equanimous now, so I can change gears. Because I wanted to make an announcement about kind of a news about our scene here. And that's interests some of you. Some of you are already getting hints about it, rumors about it. So it's a good thing. And that is that, so we have a retreat center about 2 years, 4 years ago. So we bought this property in Santa Cruz to have as a retreat, residential retreat center, to do residential meditation retreats. We opened it about 2 years ago. And we have a great retreat center and a beautiful place, a wonderful place to do retreats. Today, as those of you know, Joseph Goldstein came to see it today for the first time. And Joseph said, "I had no idea. I thought it was going to be funky." It's quite beautiful, he said. And so we have this beautiful retreat center. We've been running very nicely, nice retreats for a couple of years. And then this wonderful thing happened, and I just realized this way of understanding it in the last 2 days. We had a problem there. But I didn't know we had the problem until the solution came. Isn't that great? If you're going to have a problem, that's a good way to have a problem, right? So, we could have happily gone on for a long time. We could still go happy the way we are. But what happened was that in the end of May, the only house that's next door, the only kind of property that's next door, the rest of it's kind of forest around it, little forest, went on the market. It was for sale. And we had a very nice, supportive neighbor for many years, these years we were there. But the house is only like 50, 60 feet from the meditation hall. And first we kind of like were a little bit concerned. And like if the local rock and roll band buys it, you know, that's going to be interesting for our retreat, interesting for our equanimity practice. Or someone builds a big two-story house. It's a big property, it's an acre, so you know, build a house. So we were kind of concerned. And then we realized that having the property, and this is where the solution arises, would, we have a great retreat center, but to really allow it to thrive and to really be healthy and stable for well into the future, it'd be really useful to have a little bit more property, to have a little more housing. It's run by volunteers entirely, and we need a few more places to house the resident volunteers who help take care of so many things. And I didn't realize there was a problem with the teacher housing that we had. I was very content where I was, but now I think we have a problem. It's actually quite cramped and doesn't really work very well for the teachers to collaborate and work together, the little place we have for the teachers to live. And there are other things. And so this house is just fills it out and creates a really good scene to kind of fill out and make the place really work well for into the future. It's an acre, three-bedroom house, right next door. And we had no hope of buying it, but we did do a Hail Mary. We put a notice out saying it. You know, we can't afford to take a loan. We don't have any money for it. But if anybody out there has a lot of money, you know, you want to buy it for us, you know. So we felt we had a responsibility to at least put it out there. Turns out that at the retreat, that when this all happened, there was a wonderful supporter who, after the retreat, sent an email or let us know that what he would like to do is to buy the house for himself, buy the property, and then hold it happily, equanimously, for 5 years while we raise the money to buy it from him. So that's a pretty generous offer. It's a pretty amazing thing to someone to do. And this gave, you know, we like to do things slowly and mindfully and, you know, equanimously and so this gives us that time. So now we have this time to fundraise. And it's We're starting another fundraising campaign a little bit sooner than I would have wished, but this is how it happened, right? So we're kind of excited by this. We're kind of looking forward to it. The idea of filling out and having this extra property right next door is, I think, makes me happy with the idea of creating a better, richer, healthier place. So we're going to start the fundraising campaign in the next couple of weeks. We have a fundraising letter, and we'll let you know, those of you who come. Those of you who are new to here, don't know how we do things here, don't worry. We're not very aggressive about about fundraising, but we do our thing. And the spirit of fundraising that I like in Buddhism is how Buddhist monastics every day will go out with their begging bowl for alms. Alms means they go out for their food, so they go out with a bowl and walk the streets. And they don't ask, they just walk with the bowl open. And then people who want to will put things in. So like our fundraising letter is kind of in that spirit, it's our alms bowl. It's like, so if you're interested, you put something in. And then I'll end with a story. It's okay? Okay. Stories are good. So there's a wonderful monk, a Californian named Ajahn Sumedho, who was ordained in Thailand, lived there for many years as a monk, and then he went to London and to live there. His teacher left him in London, his Thai meditation teacher. And every morning he would go out for alms with his bowl, and many times in the early days, and when he first got there, like in the late 70s, he would leave and come back empty. No one knew, what's this guy wearing orange curtains and a bowl? And, you know, no one knew what he was about. And so he would walk the streets and come back, nothing, right? And but one day he was walking, I think, through the park or next to a park. And this jogger jogging by stopped and said, like, what? Who are you? What's going on with you? And he explained, I'm a forest monk. That's what he is, a particular kind of monk, forest monk. And I'm out walking for my alms, you know. And the guy said, oh, can I put a forest in your bowl? And he said, well, yes, I guess. And the guy said, it happens, I inherited or I have this forest in Chidhurst, I mean, kind of building too on it. And I'd like to give it to you. And that became their first monastery in England. So anyway, so our fundraising letters are our alms bowl. So if you want to ask more questions about that, you can stay afterwards and ask me how it's going with it. But that's the big news and I wanted to share it with the community. So thank you for this evening. And I hope that you will consider and explore and the topic of equanimity for this week and your relationship to it and how it might work for you. And may your inner Mara and inner Buddha work it out.